Now, one of the obvious phenomena of major significance and importance in the world today is the growth of religious fundamentalism and the gravitation of large numbers of people toward fundamentalist versions, literalist, absolutist versions of these various religions, in particular the monotheistic religions of Christianity and Islam. This is a phenomenon within Judaism as well, and also in Hinduism, but on a world scale, Christianity, Islam, the rallying of people to these fundamentalist trends within these religions is a more significant and large scale phenomenon. So I want to I've spoken this elsewhere, and I want to briefly sort of review some of the underlying and economic as well as political factors that are contributing to this, and how do we understand this phenomenon from a materialist and dialectical standpoint. One of the things that marks today's world, as we've spoken about, is the whole increase in globalization, and along with that goes a whole increase in the tempo of accumulation and change as the motor of capitalist accumulation is sped up, so to speak. That's why metaphors like turbo capitalism are used to describe this, and they're the title of a book, for example, by Edward Luttbach, to which I referred in various talks and writings. And so we see the acceleration of change coming from alien forces, change coming from the top being imposed on people, or seemingly coming from some other source outside of people's life experiences and their understanding of the world, and disrupting in massive ways the life of huge numbers of people. People being driven out of the countryside in the millions and tens of millions. Throughout Latin America, where we see religious fundamentalism growing, as we've talked about, in the form of Protestant, evangelical, and in particular Pentecostal forms of Christianity. Throughout large parts of the world where Islam, in the Middle East and elsewhere, where Islam has been the dominant religion, we see the tremendous growth of Islamic fundamentalism in connection, again, with this phenomenon of people from Iran to Turkey to Egypt and other places being uprooted from their traditional ways of life and traditional relations and customs, finding themselves hurled from a familiar way of life in a village into these shanty towns surrounding the cities, being unable to be integrated in any kind of, as they call it, articulated way into the economic and social fabric of the society. In many of these countries, a majority, or some at least, a majority of the people in these urban areas, including the shanty towns, work in the informal economy as small peddlers or traders of various kinds, or small artisans, or, you know, in underground and illegal aspects of the economy. And all this is coming not only under the, you know, from seemingly strange and alien forces, but is associated with, in the third world, where most of this is occurring, not only, it's also occurring in the U.S. and other countries that are not part of the third world, but in much of the places in the world where this is occurring, it's coming as part of the whole intensified domination of outside powers, of alien powers, of imperialism, in other words. And it's associated with ruling classes which are, to use a Marxist term, compradors, collaborators with imperialism, who have been, in many cases, put into power and maintained in power directly by imperialism, or in any case have been supported in power by imperialism, and are, in fact, seen by the masses as corrupt. But this view of these ruling classes as corrupt is a contradictory phenomenon. They're partly seen as corrupt because they do serve imperialism, and they take what part of the wealth that's produced by the people that they can get and spend it lavishly on themselves. But they're also viewed as corrupt by a lot of the masses, partly spontaneously and partly under the influence of religious authorities, as being corrupt because they've capitulated culturally and religiously to the west, to imperialism, that they've gone away from the true ways of the religion. So it's a contradictory phenomenon. As I've mentioned before, it's now for the first time in the history of the world, it's now a fact that half of the world's population lives in urban areas, including these massive and ever-growing shanty towns. This is a dramatic change which has accelerated greatly owing to the factors that I've touched on over the past few decades. And we find that these shanty towns in particular, though not only there, is, if you'll pardon the expression, a breeding ground for this kind of religious fundamentalism. People feeling the loss of their traditional ways, custom values and relations, and the associated religion, but not being yet won to, not yet taking up some radically different worldview, so they easily gravitate toward the assertion of a more fundamentalist view of this religion, something absolute to hang on to in the midst of what seems to be, you know, a never-ending chaos and volatility and insecurity. And then there are the political factors that have gone along with this, one of which we should not fail to understand was the reversal in China. The loss of that as a living example of a radical, indeed revolutionary and emancipating alternative to imperialism and to everything that imperialism imposes on masses of people through force and through its underlying dynamics and the combination of all that. But there are also, besides the reversal in China coming not that long after the restoration of capitalism in the Soviet Union in the 1950s, and then in today's world on top of that, the Soviet Union openly imploding, having pretended to be a socialist country up until the time that it basically flew apart and its empire disintegrated in the form in which it existed. All this has led to this notion, widely propagated and propagandized, of the demise and defeat of communism, which is widely spread and seeps down to and is influencing broad masses of people. But it's not only communism. It's other forms of secular opposition to imperialism and to key outposts and key aspects of imperialist rule or embodiments of imperialist rule and instruments of imperialist rule throughout the world. For example, from Israel to Palestine to Egypt and other places, the imperialists have consciously set out to defeat and decimate even nationalist secular opposition, and in fact, to feed the growth of religious fundamentalist forces, partly because, for example, in relation to Afghanistan, they saw this as being useful to them. They figured they could rally the mujahideen, the religious fighters, the fundamentalist religious fighters, to be the most fanatical fighters against the Soviets. Other people could have been rallied to be determined fighters against Soviet occupation, but they couldn't have been rallied to be determined fanatical reactionary fighters against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. In Egypt, there was a whole phenomenon of Nasser, and Nasserism, which wasn't limited to Egypt, but whose influence was very widespread after, you know, Nasser came to power in the 1950s. This was a big phenomenon, sort of Arab nationalism and taking the form of Nasserism among the Arab peoples and broadly in that part of the world. And this, you know, without going into too much detail, you can see the complexity of all this because, not, you know, people, partly for correct reasons and partly out of pragmatism and that people are encouraged to fall into, there's not a one-to-one, but a not-so-distant relationship between how successful a particular political movement or form of rule is and how the masses of people rally or don't rally to it, especially in the absence of communist leadership. But there's that spontaneous tendency which often is powerfully expressed. And it's complex because, for example, Nasser, in the 1950s, got into a big struggle over the dam, the Aswan Dam in Egypt, and the Suez Canal, in which Israel and France and England were on one side and Nasser was on the other, and to show the complexity of things, the U.S. opposed Israel, France, and Britain in that particular case. They were trying to move against Nasser to keep him from gaining more control over the Suez Canal. And, you know, it's not that the U.S. wanted to support Arab nationalism, or Nasser in particular. It's that they were moving, as a result of World War II, to supplant all these old imperialist powers who had been the colonial powers that had dominated this part of the world. As a result of World War I, as I've referred to elsewhere, France and England basically divided up the Middle East between them. Some of it was given to this French sphere of influence, became essentially French colonies or neo-colonies, and others went to England when they broke up and defeated the old Ottoman Empire through World War I. The spoils were split that way. But then after World War II, they were weakened through that war, France and Britain, and the U.S. was strengthened. And even though the U.S. had already begun to swing support to Israel beyond that which was given by England, the U.S. had to make sure that things were in their proper place and proper order. And it was, you know, Eisenhower asserting American power to say, we are now the top dogs here. Your heyday in this part of the world is over. You step back, and even Israel, get in line. You're going to be our instrument now. Get in line with the way things are in this new situation that's emerged. And it took them about a decade from the mid-40s to the mid-50s for some of this to get sorted out in various parts of the world, including the Middle East. So as a result of this, Nasser got a tremendous following, both because of what he was putting forward ideologically and programmatically, but also because he got a victory here of a sort through these complex effects. This is how complex things can be. But then the U.S. began, while, you know, not seeking to overtly overthrow Nasser immediately, began to work to undermine Nasserism and generally more secular forces, including, obviously, communist forces that were opposed to its rule and that were opposed to Israel. And Israel, too, you know, it's very complex. Israel in its history has supported and fostered some of these Islamic fundamentalist forces while seeking to undermine the more secular forces of opposition among the Palestinian people. And again, you see the complexity. Nasser viciously repressed. Today we hear about how he viciously suppressed the Islamic fundamentalist forces like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, but we don't hear about how he viciously suppressed and killed the communists. And the same thing was going on in Syria and Iraq, for example. So it's a very complex picture, but generally the imperialists worked to undermine secular and in particular communists and revolutionary forces, but even secular bourgeois nationalist forces, and increasingly were, out of necessity and conscious design, working to build up religious fundamentalist forces in opposition to this, and or taking actions which led to the fostering and strengthening of Islamic fundamentalist forces. So this is the political dimension that combines with these economic and social factors of upheaval and volatility and rapid change imposed from the top and seemingly coming from unknown or alien forces. All this combines together to undermine secular forces and to strengthen religious fundamentalist forces. And I spoke in another talk about Iran and Afghanistan and how advances the U.S. made had a significant aspect in which they turned to their opposites and became problems for the U.S. This is a really glaring example of that. Is Indonesia. And it relates directly to this phenomenon of Islamic fundamentalism once again. During the 1950s and 1960s, Indonesia had the third largest communist party in the world. Only the party of the Soviet Union and China, only those parties were larger. And it had a massive following among the poor and the shanty towns and among the peasants in the countryside. I mean, the slums of Jakarta and other cities in in Indonesia have been and are legendary in a negative sense. And the communists had a massive following there and among the peasants in the countryside and among sections of the intellectuals and even some bourgeois strata. Unfortunately, they also had a very eclectic line, a mixed bag of communism and revisionism, of seeking revolution but also trying to work through parliamentary means for the established government. The established government at that time was headed by the nationalist leader Sukarno, whose daughter recently became the head of government a couple of years ago in Indonesia. But Sukarno was a nationalist figure and hero coming out of World War II, and he was the head of a sort of a bourgeois nationalist government, and the communists were in an alliance with him and in the same government. And when I was in China, they told us what we used to say to Comrade Adit, who was the head of that party, we warned him about what could happen, trying to have one foot in this and one foot in that, one foot in communism and revolution and one foot in reformism and revisionism. But they persisted in that path. And at a certain point, the U.S., through the CIA and working with the military and Suharto, who was a general in the military who came to power and ruled for several decades, until he was found to be no longer useful, and then was determined, lo and hold, to be corrupt and was driven out of office. But he and the Indonesian military, you see, the state was still in the hands of the reactionary classes. The parliament, largely in the hands of nationalists and communists, but the state was still in the hands of the reactionary classes. Here's a very important lesson. This is what the Chinese comrades were trying to say to the Indonesians. They told us a story about how Sukarno had this scepter that he used to carry around. And the Chinese had dealings with Sukarno too, and so they asked him, well, what is this scepter you carry around? And Sukarno said, this scepter represents state power. And then this Chinese comrade telling the story said, well, Sukarno still has the scepter. They let him keep that, but he doesn't have any state power, because he was deposed in a coup that the CIA, working with the military that still control the actual state power, carried off in Indonesia in 1965. And they slaughtered hundreds of thousands, between 500,000 and 1 million people, in the space of a few months. There's stories of how the rivers around Jakarta, they would just kill people, alleged or actual communists, and throw them in the rivers. And the rivers were piled so high with bodies that they became clogged. And another thing to take note of, because there's something that in certain ways we're all too familiar with, is once they began to unleash this coup that the CIA led and organized and engineered and carried out, effected through the Indonesian military, all kinds of people who had personal or family disputes and feuds going would start accusing other people of being communists and turning them into the government, so that a lot of people who weren't even communists got slaughtered along with those who were, because people got caught up in the kind of thing that you saw like in Rwanda or something. Once the imperialists unleashed this bloodletting, then people who were looking for, caught up in personal revenge and personal feuds or long-standing family feuds was a sort of on a feudal patriarchal basis going back for generations, would turn each other in as communists. This is what can happen when this kind of madness and bloodlust gets unleashed and directed. It was directed. The CIA openly brags about how they specifically targeted several thousand of the communist leaders and got rid of them directly within this larger massacre of hundreds of thousands. So that Communist Party was totally destroyed, physically, virtually exterminated, with only a few remnants of it here and there. It's never yet been able to regroup. And it was politically and ideologically decimated and defeated as well. And over the decades since then, what has happened? The tremendous growth of Islamic fundamentalism in Indonesia. The communist alternative was wiped out. And its place partly being overtly fostered by the, and consciously fostered by the imperialists and other reactionary forces, but partly growing on its own momentum in the context where this secular and at least communist in name opposition had been destroyed. It filled the vacuum, if you want to put it that way, to a certain, in a certain dimension, that had been left by the lack of a real alternative to this highly oppressive government that, of Suharto and his cronies. It was installed and kept in power by the U.S. and meanwhile was massacring people on East Timor and so on, with the backing of the U.S. government all the way through Clinton, all the way up to Clinton, including Clinton. So these factors combine and have combined over generations to give a tremendous impetus to the growth of religious fundamentalism. And we can see it in the underlying economic base, and we can see it in the superstructure and the back and forth between the two. And once again, the phenomenon we're observing, and it's important to be very clear on this, is outmoded, obsolete, reactionary social strata among the oppressed part of humanity going up against and taking leadership over people and going up in that form and on that basis against outmoded, obsolete strata of the ruling circles of imperialism. And those are the alternatives that in many parts of the world are now being posed as the two poles of opposition. And as I've emphasized before, these are not the only two alternatives. And there is a tremendous amount of work to be done in the whole world and in many strategic parts of the world to repolarize, including within the U.S. itself, because this is also a phenomenon within the U.S. of great and growing significance, including among important sections of the proletariat and other oppressed masses who have to be brought forward as a powerful base, a key part of the base and driving forces of revolution if there is to be a proletarian and communist revolution in this country as part of the world revolution. So this is not a minor phenomenon. It's a tremendously important phenomenon. It's part of necessity. It's part of the objective reality in a negative form now that we communists throughout the world have to confront and transform. And in order to do that, you have to, first of all, engage and understand it, understand where it's coming from, what contradictions and what particular expressions of essential and fundamental contradictions is it the particular and even peculiar expression of? And how? What are the dynamics driving that? And how can you, in the Leninist sense, divert that and transform it into something else? And it's also, there's the same task very acutely in the U.S. There's a conscious strategy by sections of the ruling class, including those predominating now, to go after the very social basis that we correctly identify as the main base and driving force of the proletarian revolution, and to catch them up in this reactionary religious fundamentalism and its political expression. This is another manifestation of the complexity of what we have to deal with. Now, I have to admit, without getting subjective here, to a certain amount of frustration about this, because I've been trying to call attention to this phenomenon for quite a while now, more than a decade. And to be honest, a lot that's been met with a lot of, yeah, we know it's reactionary, what's the big deal? But yes, it's reactionary. I mean, this is another one of these things. We, you know, it's like dogma. You know, dogma is as valuable as dog shit or less, okay? It's religion. It's religious fundamentalism. It's reactionary. Why talk about that? Let's go talk about something else. Because this is a major phenomenon. This is a major part of the necessity that's been developing and strengthening in a negative way that we have to go up against and transform over this whole period of time, and yet we've not been sufficiently or anywhere near sufficiently engaging in seeking to transform it, and first of all, to understand it and where it's coming from and what's driving it, and therefore how we might actually go about repolarizing in relation to it. Now, my frustration is not personal here. It's a frustration based on in relation to our whole objectives and what we are supposed to be and need to be all about. You know, there's a tendency among people who are people of the Enlightenment, shall we say, communists and others, to fall into sort of an ironically kind of arrogant attitude toward this. Because this seems so absurd and ridiculous to us, we don't take seriously, as we should, the fact that this in turn is taken very seriously by masses of people. We either ignore it altogether or we act like it's a superficial phenomenon. And if we just come up and say to these masses a few pieces of dogma with a communist coloration, we're going to win them away from that, from all this. And that's not going to happen. We're not going to win them away by tailing this. I mean, after all, if you listen to the first part of this talk, it was hardly tailing this. But we have to be able to understand it in a scientific and an all-around deep-going way in order to be able to engage it and in order to be able to win masses of people away from it, among all strata of the people, but including very strategically among the basic lower, deeper sections of the proletariat and other oppressed masses who are going to have to be at the very base and bedrock and driving force of the revolution that can actually lead to emancipation. So we need to accelerate ourselves and make leaps quickly, very quickly, in a very telescope way in our understanding of the importance of this phenomenon in the world as well as in this country in particular. And not allow ourselves to even inadvertently fall into the arrogance of the enlightened, of not taking this seriously because it seems so absurd to us. That is not what the masses of people need us to do. That is not acting according to the responsibilities of a vanguard that is serious about what we need to be serious about. It's actually, ironically, a form of contempt for the masses, just as tailing after all this garbage would be a form of contempt for the masses. And not taking it on in the correct ways, in a deeply rooted way, and winning people away from it by actually understanding what it is and what its pull is on people. So I throw that out there, or put that out there as something for us to think very deeply about. We're way behind on this, and it's a crucial arena of the whole struggle. We don't have time to slowly catch up to the reality that we're confronted with in this dimension, as well as others. Now, another way to understand this phenomenon, or another, on the surface, sort of strange and unexpected phenomenon, is that here in the world you have this highly developed technology. And you have all this information that's accessible if you have access to that technology, the internet and all these other things, instant information about all kinds of things. And yet, at one and the same time, you have this highly developed, you know, nanotechnology and all these technologies and surgery and every sphere of medicine and in every other, human sphere of human endeavor. And at one and the same time as you have that, you have this tremendous growth of what, yes, let's call it what it is, organized ignorance in the form of religious fundamentalism. And this seems to be not only a glaring but a strange contradiction. So much technology and knowledge on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, so much widespread ignorance and belief in and retreat into obscurantist superstitions. Now, as I was just saying, we can just dismiss it all. Ignorance, obscurantist superstition. What's the problem? Nobody who's serious about anything would fall into that. No, I've already spoken to how dangerous and wrong that is. But we should... What is the cause of this phenomenon? What is the cause of this glaring and somewhat seeming peculiar contradiction of tremendous, you know, so much technology and knowledge, and yet so much widespread ignorance and belief and retreat into obscurantist superstition? Well, I've spoken to this in terms of economic, social, and political factors that go into it, or at least some of them. But another way to look at it is this is an extremely acute expression in today's world of the fundamental contradiction of capitalism. Where is all this technology, and for that matter, all the basis for disseminating knowledge, and where is even the basis for people to acquire knowledge? What is that founded on? It's founded on all the wealth that's produced in socialized forms by millions and millions of people through an international network of production and exchange and accumulation. But all that takes place under the command of a relative to the great masses of humanity, a tiny handful of capitalists who appropriate all the wealth produced and who appropriate the knowledge produced as well and bend it to their purposes. And what is this an illustration of? It is, for one thing, it's a refutation of the theory of the productive forces. That the more technology you have, the more enlightenment there'll be and the closer you'll be to socialism or to communism. Well, look around the world. Why? Why is that not the case? Why doesn't that follow? Because we're back again to this fundamental fact. All these productive forces go through certain production relations, get expressed as certain social and class relations, and find their expression in the superstructure. It's not just productive forces, all this technology and knowledge and everything, just out there, and it just gets somehow, in some formless way, distributed, however it might. It has to and can only go through one or another set of production, social, and class relations with the corresponding customs, cultures, ways of thinking, political institutions, and so on. So that what is happening? All this technology is going through the existing capitalist and imperialist relations and superstructure, and coming out in this extremely grotesque disparity between what's appropriated by a tiny handful and what's measured out to broader strata in some of the imperialist countries to stabilize those countries and to mollify and pacify sections of the population who aren't part of the ruling class there, while amongst the great majority of humanity there's unbelievable poverty and suffering and ignorance, yes. Technology doesn't just go to the people. It goes through, as everything does, whatever the existing production relations are that people enter into in the creation and development of this technology and of the productive forces in general. And so what we're seeing with this great disparity in the world, this sort of peculiar and, if you will, howling contradiction between so much technology and so much knowledge on the one hand, and yet such widespread ignorance and belief and retreat into obscurantist superstition on the other hand, is an expression in very acute form of the fundamental contradiction of capitalism and of the fact that this is all still going through the four alls rather than the overcoming of those four alls. This is an extremely important point to understand. If you're sort of linear in your thinking, you couldn't understand. Well, look, I don't get it. There's all this technology, there's all this ability to do all these things, there's all this knowledge. Why are people so ignorant? because of the production, the social, the class relations, the political institutions, and the rest of the superstructure, the ways of thinking, the customs, the habits, the culture, that reinforce all that. Under this system of capitalist accumulation and capitalist relations. And in its imperialist stage is a worldwide interwoven system of exploitation and oppression. And that's only going to be overcome through the revolution to wrest now one part, now another part of the world out of the hands of these imperialists and begin to then take the conscious initiative of the masses of proletarians and others led by a communist vanguard forces to begin transforming this and ultimately achieving that on a world scale. So this is another perspective, an important perspective in which to understand the phenomenon of religious fundamentalism. The more this disparity grows, the more there is, to put it that way again, a breeding ground, a basis for the growth of various forms of religious fundamentalism and related tendencies. At the same time, there is also a greater and greater basis for revolutionary transformation. But that's where we have to come in all the correct ways, dealing with all the contradictions and all the complexities involved. And not by simple-minded, linear, reductionist, economist, and all these other ways of flattening out reality until it's really has, you know, our conception of it bears no relationship to the actual reality and therefore how to actually transform it. Next, I want to talk about different aspects of religion and its influence, especially in the world today. And I want to talk particularly about the three main monotheistic religions, is Judaism and Christianity and Islam, and their influence in various ways. And one of the most important aspects of this is religion as a concentrated, and these religions in particular, but not only them, as a concentrated expression of and reinforcement of patriarchy. All of these religions are patriarchal religions. Each one of them pictures a god that is a male authority figure. The father, the lord, señor, however, whatever language it's in. And it is a, these are religions in which patriarchal relations are projected into an otherworldly form to then be in turn reimposed on this world. And in which patriarchy is an integral, and the reinforcement of patriarchy is an integral and essential part of the belief system and of the behavior that this belief system is intended to enforce as part of the broader network of oppressive and exploitative relations. These religions promote a strong father figure, absolute male authority, both in terms of how they portray the god of their religion, and this is, of course, all the more so in the fundamentalist versions, but it resides in this, right in the heart of the scriptures of all these religions, and it also promotes and reinforces patriarchal relations and patriarchal domination within among human beings and their society as well. One of the big attractions of these religions to people who've lived in a society in which patriarchy and the oppression of women and male domination is an integral and indispensable part, a part without which the society in that form could not exist. One of the attractions of the fundamentalist versions of these religions in particular in this period is as a reassertion of that patriarchy. Why is there a felt need for the reassertion? Because the patriarchy is being undermined in various ways. Not eliminated, not qualitatively transformed, but being undermined in various ways by the very functioning of the society. Even in countries where, you know, where there's still very powerful, open patriarchal traditions, the uprooting of people and all that has a tendency to undermine aspects of the patriarchy. People going into the cities. You know, families moving from Pakistan to London. Families moving from Egypt or Turkey to Germany. From Algeria to France. And they have very different culture and customs. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not an apologist for bourgeois society and its forms of the oppression of women. But it's very different in these countries than it is in the countries where feudalism continues to exist, a more significant influence, and where, along with that, patriarchal traditions are more overt and more entrenched in a traditional form. That's important to emphasize, in a traditional form. So all of a sudden, the fathers who've had absolute authority, all of a sudden they got these daughters in these entirely new circumstances and, you know, supervising the behavior of daughters is one of the main roles of the father with the assistance of the mother. Often the mother or mother-in-law or whatever will be the enforcer of this. But this is one of the main patriarchal functions. I'll get into some discussion of how this comes out in the scriptures as we go along. So all of a sudden, you know, the it's like what happens when people get, in rural areas, get MTV. In the internet, all of a sudden the kids, you know, they don't want to act in the traditional ways anymore. Or at least some of them don't. Become very unruly, a lot of clashes within the families. Even in a, you know, quote-unquote advanced country like this. Well, you imagine people moving from Algeria to France. It's a whole different kind of oppressive social relations. Not social relations that are not oppressive, but a whole different kind that envisions and embodies a different role for women and a different way in which they're oppressed. And it's very complex because a lot of the ways in which women are oppressed in a society like this, or France, is in a form which appears to be, you know, especially to people coming from a traditionalist standpoint, appears to be an excess of freedom. They're not regulated and required to wear traditional clothing in the same way, to act in the same, quote-unquote, modest way. And it goes to, you know, highly exploitive extremes. There's pornography or virtual pornography, soft or hardcore, everywhere you turn. The advertisement is based on, to a very significant degree, on the use of the female body to sell commodities. And then the female body itself is a, in a very developed way, an extensive way, is a commodity throughout the society. So these things tend to reinforce each other. You know, even people who aren't steeped in traditional religious shit look at a lot of this shit and justifiably say, well, this is terrible. I don't want my kids exposed to this. And then if you're coming from a whole patriarchal, traditional patriarchal form, well, then you recoil too, and you want to more forcefully reassert the patriarchy, and that reinforces the already existing imposition of patriarchal authority. So you got this very poisonous brew. And there's a lot of reaction against that in the form of the forceful reassertion of patriarchy. Even if people don't go from a third world country to an imperialist country, if they go into the cities are different in the third world countries than the countryside. And the way of life is different in the shanty towns. It's volatile, but it's different than the traditional life in the countryside. So there's a lot of attraction to a religion which forcefully asserts traditional patriarchal authority and reinforces that patriarchal authority with supernatural power behind it, or seeming supernatural power. And then more generally, in a world that's very uncertain and seems threatening in a lot of ways, both economically, but not just economically, all of a sudden you have September 11th and all these other things, there's a strong tendency for people to want to gravitate to a big, strong daddy who's going to protect them. This is something that, for example, Bush and those around him consciously play on. I'm a wartime president. I'm the big, strong father figure that's going to keep you safe if you just get in line with me. And there's a whole religious fundamentalist package that's promoted to reinforce that. So that's another form in which amidst uncertainty, volatility, and the feeling of threats, and this feeling is not only spontaneous, it's also promoted and reinforced every time I turn around. It's not accidental that if you turn on the news in almost any part of the U.S., what do you see? Crime, crime, crime. You know, you think that you were about ready to be jumped on by somebody every time you went out your front door. Even though the actual possibilities, particularly if you're in the middle strata of encountering crime, is very minimal. So that adds to this general feeling of uncertainty and threat. And what's a way that, you know, traditionally in a society that for thousands of years has been based on, among other things, powerful patriarchal authority, what's a way to feel you can get some security? A big, strong daddy. A big, powerful father figure wielding big weapons. Who's going to protect you? Who's going to get those bad guys out there before they can get you? And then there, you know, but just asserting that in a human form is not enough to hold for many, many people. So there's a promotion of the whole patriot, an assertion of the traditional, an aggressive assertion, and an even assertion, an even more extremely absolutist form of the powerful father figure, both in supernatural and in human form, and in the somewhat conscious and somewhat unconscious association of people between the two. Now, another big aspect of the way in which patriarchy is being threatened and people feel it threatened, for example, in a society like the U.S., this is now very acutely posed, is the whole gay question. It's not that gay marriage in itself is going to undermine and destroy patriarchy. It's not. It'll reassert it, actually, in certain ways, spontaneously. But at this juncture, a challenge of that kind to the traditional marriage and the traditional property relations that are embodied in and suggested by that marriage does pose a very serious ideological and in some ways political challenge to traditional patriarchy. It's not at all literally true, as we point out, that God ordained a marriage to be between one man and one woman. We point out, there was a little thing in the paper there, you know, Ask God, on the back of the recent issue of the paper, which went into how David and Solomon had hundreds of wives and concubines, and Abraham had more than one wife, and went into his wife's servant when she was apparently barren and couldn't bear him children, and so on and so forth. And there's a whole tradition of taking, like, if your brother's wife, you know, if your brother got killed, you would take on his wife in addition to your wife. So there's all this kind of, you know, stuff in the Bible and in that whole tradition. But as we've seen, these Christian fascists, you know, are not bound by what's literally in the Bible. They do their own salad barring when they want to, and they rewrite what's actually in the Bible when it serves their reactionary purposes. But this whole, you know, and then there's the whole thing. God created Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. You know, this is a popular thing spread around. Well, you know, here you see once again the importance of evolution, among other things. And I'll get back to that later. You know, God didn't create either Adam and Eve or Adam and Steve. Human beings evolved. And in the history of human beings, they have had different societies, many different sexual relations and practices, both exploitive and not exploitive, depending on the basic character of the society. Now, this is something when we went and reviewed and struggled over and criticized and changed our whole position on this question, we went and did a lot of study much more deeply into the whole history of this and learned a lot more about the very great diversity and variety of sexual relations of different kinds in different periods of history and different societies. So there is no a man in ancient Greek society, a real man's man, had sexual relations with other men and boys all the time. That was a real man's man did that. Well, we're not about promoting a man's man, okay? Or any other kind of man in the sense of male domination. Human beings, yes. Proletarian revolution to emancipate human beings, yes. But in a society that, which patriarchy has been a key thing holding the whole thing together, the assertion of breaking out of the traditional forms of the patriarchy at particular junctures like right now can become very volatile and pose a very serious challenge, even while many of the people themselves are simply trying to form traditional marriages. That's another one of the ironies and complexities of this. And that you see in response to this, it's not simply an election gimmick to get more Republicans elected. Yes, some Republican Party functionaries are using this issue, but it's much more profound than that and has much bigger implications. And this is all, this is all very deeply rooted. This whole assertion of patriarchy, but now it's being challenged at every turn. Not in a way that's going to lead to its abolition, but in a way that does undermine some of the forms in which it's existed. And the religious fundamentalism is a forceful and absolutist, even more extremely absolutist, reassertion of this in response to these challenges and these factors that even spontaneously are tending to undermine it in the particular set of contradictions that are now pertaining and influencing things in society and the world. You also see this coming out in relation to how to rear children, how to bring up children, what should be the relationships in the family. You see the forceful reassertion of patriarchy. And you see some of these religious fundamentalists, a big part of their emphasis is that, this country started going to the hell and we could no longer physically beat the children and keep them in line. After all, what does the Bible say? Everybody knows, or many people know that old saying, the old saying from the Bible, spare the rod and spoil the child. Or as it literally says in Proverbs 23:13-14, withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beatest him with the rod, he shall not die. Thou shalt beat him with the rod, and shalt deliver his soul from hell. And this is what a lot of these Christian fundamentalist leaders are actively promoting. That the country, among other challenges to the absolute authority of the patriarchal figure, the country has started going to hell ever since you couldn't apply this important directive from Proverbs, this important principle of don't spare the rod or you'll spoil the child and send him to hell or her to hell. Now here I have to say, as should be obvious, I love Richard Pryor, but okay, Richard, I'm sorry you're gone. But enough of this shit about grandma and the switch beating me, okay? I know it was always contradictory in the routines that he did. But I have to say, honestly, there was always also a certain upholding of, well, after all, this did keep me from getting completely out of line And then it takes much cruder form in some of these other comedians these days. Bernie Mac and people like that, going on and on. And even among people who are in many ways advanced politically, among the basic masses, you'll hear this complaint. Well, things are all fucked up now because you can't beat your kids anymore. Can't get out that switch like grandma did and beat the kid back into line so they do right. And even though it was grandma wielding the switch sometimes, it was still done as part of an overall assertion of relations in which it was patriarchal domination. The strong father figure who disciplined and kept the kids in line and who kept the daughters as virgins so they'd be pure property to be traded to their husbands when the time came. And who sent the sons out, or sends the sons out even today, to kill the daughters if they are no longer virgins before marriage, even as a result of being raped. This is what goes along with, as a part of a whole package of grandma with the switch. And we should understand this. We need to be thoroughly rid of this. Girl children and children in general are not property of parents in a patriarchal setup. That's not the world we're aiming for. That's what they've been for thousands of years, but that's not how we want the world to be. Yes, kids need discipline. But they don't need to be beaten with a switch or a rod to get discipline. And to have a sense of purpose. Increasingly, they need to be inspired and, yes, at times, taken in hand and led as part of an overall vision of remaking the world. And as they become older and more capable, they can become more consciously a part of that. But even before they're capable of being consciously a part of it, the principles that apply to that can, as much as possible, can and should be applied in relating to children, your own and others. Children are conscious human beings, even though their consciousness is still in a state of, early development when they're young. They can be reasoned with, and yes, at times they have to be told, yes, that's the way it is. Because the ability to understand this and why it has to be this way is beyond you right now. And you have to, there are all kinds of, you can see why people gravitate toward this, spare the rod, spoil a child, because there are all kinds of things pulling kids in terrible directions. But you beat a kid, you're perpetuating the passing of that down from one generation to the next, and it's not just going to be the kids that get beaten. And it's going to be the masses in antagonistic relationships with each other and moving against what will actually emancipate the masses of people and get us to a whole different world beyond all this patriarchy and beyond the forceful and violent imposition of authority, even over other people in your own supposed loving relationship of a family. Now, I'm not an idealist in any sphere. I've seen lots of kids run around crazy. And I while I don't agree with them on many things these days, I do have to share a certain point of unity with George Carlin when he talks about excessive permissiveness. And he does that whole routine, which we echoed from time to time, Well, I want to say something about the way people are raising their kids. He's not going to say something bad about the kids, is he? Yes, he is. And, some of it is tied up with, frankly, some, sort of Menshevism, if you want to put it that way, sort of narrow working class revengeism toward yuppies or whatever. But there's a lot of points that he's making that are valid about excessive permissiveness, which, frankly, is all wrapped up with a lot of commodity views of commodity relations with regard to kids. The parents that start playing symphonies for their, to the stomach of the pregnant mother. So the kid will have a, start getting educated and trained to become, you know, to go to Juilliard or whatever when they're a teenager. And there's a lot of permissiveness that goes along with that. And a lot of, see, you need leadership. You need vanguards, even within relationship of families as they are now. Kids need to be led. Yes, they need to be increasingly reasoned with, but they need to be led. And they, yes, they need to be taken in hand, but they don't need to be beaten with the rod and the switch. And that is an assertion of patriarchal authority, which works against and undermines the kind of world that we need to be striving for and the kind of revolutionary movement we need to be building to get beyond all these oppressive relations in which ultimately children are still being viewed as the extension and, in effect, the property of the parents and, more specifically, the father. So, yes, you can see the pull. A lot of people, you know, in the oppressed communities look around and see the kids acting a fool and acting crazy and doing all kinds of crazy shit. And they feel like something strong's got to get these fucking kids in line. That's why you see what's held up here for people. What are the two alternatives that are held up among the oppressed, in particular in the U.S. right now? What two ways can they go, if you will? Well, you got the gangs on the one hand, with all the madness and mayhem that gets caught up, gets involved in all that, or the church on the other, with all the assertion of traditional, oppressive, and yes, patriarchal values, relations, codes, customs, and the enforcement of that. Neither of which offers a way forward for the masses of people out of this oppression that's driving them to a lot of madness in the first place. So here again is another example of where we have to use a certain phrase, break through the middle. Just like it can't be jihad and world and crusade in the world is the only two alternatives, but we have to find a radically different, not find, but bring forward a radically different alternative through the communist revolution and the communist world outlook and the communist program and objectives. So among the oppressed, we have to bring forward an alternative to the madness and mayhem that a lot of the youth get caught up in under the compulsion of what the system is doing to them and the spontaneous way in which they react to that and try to make a way through it. Or on the other hand, the church is a way of clamping down on them with oppressive and patriarchal authority. We have to bring forward a powerful revolutionary alternative to those things. We have to be saying boldly to people, we don't need the church, we don't need the switch, we don't need the rod, and yes, we don't need the gangs and the drugs, we need revolution. And you can tell me that all that revolution talk's not going to go anywhere, but where is this other shit going? And where has it gone? And where has it led? And where has it brought us? And what has it brought us to? And is that anything we want to live in? So this may be hard, but this is hard in the service of something that's going to take us away from and out of all this, toward the overthrow of all this, and the radical transformation of this here and all over the world. And that's what we have to be struggling with people about. We have to very, very powerfully bring this forward without any hesitancy. Or else tell me that this other shit's better. Those are the choices. Let's just go to the mass and say, okay, this gang shit or the churches or both, that's better. That's all we can do. Those are the only choices. So pick one or other or do one and then the other. When you get tired of the gangs, then go to the church. You get sick of the church, then go back to the gangs. Either let us not talk falsely now. Either those are the only alternatives, and that's the best we can have, or it's not. And I say it's not. And scientific assessment of reality says it's not. So let's take the masses. What is actually, yes, it's a hard road. What the fuck are people dying and killing each other over now? What is that for? What is that bringing about? What is that reinforcing? Where is that leading people? What good is that doing for anyone? Except those who rule over us. And who couldn't be happier than to see us either killing ourselves and each other over the control of a corner which we don't control anyway, and can be snatched away anytime they want to, or over going down on our knees to some patriarchal authority, which is part of our oppression in the first place and is binding us all and one half humanity, binding him doubly. I say our responsibility is to tell the masses the truth and then to struggle with them about that. Not to lie to them about reality or make it seem simpler than it is, but also not to capitulate to the ways in which the system is pushing them to do shit that's against their own interests and is going to keep them from generation after generation in the same horrors. Now I want to move on and talk about a phrase that I've used a number of times in referring to Christianity, in particular Christian fundamentalism in the U.S. At one point I said in a talk, have you ever noticed that the Bible Belt in the U.S. is also the lynching belt? Those parts of the country where fundamentalist religion has been historically and most powerfully rooted, and is so even today, are also very directly related to and very strongly overlap with those parts of the country where first slavery and then Jim Crow and the KKK and lynching have historically been based, and from which they have now are spreading this fundamentalism to other parts of the country. It's interesting how things go. You know, when I came up with this phrase about the Bible Belt, you know, have you ever noticed the Bible Belt is a lynching belt? I knew that there was something to that, but I was sure enough of it to put it forward as a truth because I could see the phenomenon. But I was wrestling with, well, how to understand that more deeply. Why is that phenomenon that way? Is this just sort of an accidental association? It seemed definitely not. But what are the historical and material roots of this connection between fundamentalist religion and white supremacy, to put it that way, between the Bible Belt and the lynching belt, between Christian fundamentalism and white supremacy in the history of the U.S.? Now, one of the key events in all this was after the Civil War, the reversal and betrayal of Reconstruction in the southern U.S. I don't have time to go into it thoroughly, but just to touch on the key aspects of it quickly. Basically for a decade after the Civil War, from 1867 to 1877, the federal troops that had conquered the South remained in the South to enforce changes that were being brought about through amendments in the Constitution and government policy in general. And there was, for a very short-lived period of time, not equality, but real advances for the masses of former slaves, and even for some poor people among the whites, in terms of having land, not all the land that was promised to those who fought on the Union side in the Civil War, the famous 40 acres and a mule that you see referred to in Spike Lee movies. But there was some land acquired by former slaves, as well as some poor white farmers, but in particular former slaves. And there was a whole, if you will, package of rights within the domination of the bourgeoisie and the society and within the structure of bourgeois relations, but rights that obviously had not existed under slavery, including the right to vote, the right of association, and similar rights that had been, at least in words, granted to others through the Constitution previously. And there were a number of black elected officials during this very brief period in the legislatures of the southern states. I remember doing some research on this, and I think there was, you know, this is a weird country. You know, if you're like 1/16 black, you know, or African in your origin, you're counted as black in some of these calculations in the South. And so there was this, I still remember his name, PBS Pinchback. was, I think, became lieutenant governor of Mississippi during the period of Reconstruction, was the highest official of African origin that had existed in the South. But anyway, this is a reflection, without going into too much detail, of what was happening. And then the bourgeoisie in the North had consolidated its control of the country, including over the South, economically and politically. It had to expand further to the West. It sent the army that had fought the Civil War increasingly to the West to carry out the final phases of the conquest and genocide against the native peoples and the theft of their land and the driving of those who were left into the reservation concentration camps, in effect. And it pulled, after 10 years, as part of a political compromise within the ruling class, it pulled the army, the federal army, out of the South and ended Reconstruction and returned the masses of black people in particular to the tender mercy of old and new plantation owners and the Ku Klux Klan, which was started by former Confederate soldiers and officers seeking revenge as a result of the defeat in the Civil War. And not the Ku Klux Klan didn't come out of any old where. And along with this came the development of a certain strain of religion, Christianity, and in particular Christian fundamentalism that developed in the South, which viewed the southern U.S. somewhat like the people of ancient Israel, who'd been chastised by their God, not for slavery, but for some things unknown, and for weakening in the defense of their way of life, the southern way of life. And now there was going to be a restoration of this people, as there was when God would once more turn his favor to the ancient people of Israel. And what went along with this, not just in the South, but in the U.S. as a whole? This is something that David Brian Davis, for example, speaks to in his book In Human Bondage. Was that increasingly the actual history of the Civil War was rewritten. The role of black people in the Civil War was basically washed out of the history. Even the basic fact of what the war was fought over, that it was fought over slavery through a complex of motivations. It wasn't only moral motivation. Well, there were many people morally motivated to fight on a moral basis against slavery in the Northern Army. Inspired, for example, by the rebellion, even though unsuccessful, that had been led by John Brown shortly before the start of the Civil War. But there was a mixed bag. It was bourgeois interests that were conflicting with the slave interest and that mode of production. And there were all kinds of different motivations and interests mixed in. But slavery was nevertheless the pivotal point of the whole war. The continuation or the ending of the slave system increasingly was from the beginning and increasingly and more explicitly became the edge on which the war was fought, the issue over which it was more and more clearly fought as the war unfolded and intensified. But there began to be a rewriting of this. It became the war between the states. One side wearing gray and one side wearing blue. And then you began to have battle enactments, which were sanitized versions of what this was all about, in which people would dress up, and, you know, white people would dress up in gray uniforms and blue uniforms and reenact key battles, and it still goes on. And they even had, let's go to the realm of sports for a second, they even started what they call the blue-gray football game, which is an all-star game of college seniors from the South and from the North who play off. So this became ritualized as almost a non-antagonistic conflict within the family, even though there were deeply harbored resentment among the unreconstructed Southern segregationists and longers for the Confederacy and slavery days. It was more among the people in the North that they lost a sense of antagonism, the white people in the North in particular. So there was a rewriting of the history and cultural expressions of this rewriting. And this was linked with this fundamentalist Christianity, which I was referring to, which had its roots in the South, but began, and increasingly these days, it's very actively being spread, not only in rural areas and other parts of the country, but among the suburbs and the so-called exurbs, beyond the suburbs. And even, in a terrible and outrageous irony, this same religious fundamentalism is being spread in the inner cities as well, with its promotion by patriarchal-minded and reactionary preachers. How's the Civil War presented? Most commonly, it's presented as a great national tragedy. You want to talk about an irony? Here's a great irony. The Civil War is the one war on a far greater scale than the American Revolution. It's the one war that the American bourgeoisie fought that you could say was truly glorious. And it's the only one they're ashamed of. This is why you hear this terrible tragedy of brother killing brother. I don't know about that. I don't know if those 200,000 former slaves thought they were killing brothers when they were fighting the Confederacy. And I don't know if a lot of those white troops in the Northern Army who went to battle singing John Brown's Body thought they were killing brothers. I think they thought they were carrying on a righteous fight to end a terrible evil. But for the bourgeoisie in particular, and the way it's molded or sought to mold public opinion, this is a terrible national tragedy. And it was fought at terrible cost. It's the equivalent of something like 6 million people. If it were fought today with today's almost 300 million population in the U.S., the 600,000 that were lost in that war, were killed in that war, would be equivalent to 6 million people today. So it was fought at tremendous cost. But the people who fought it at the time, well, actually on both sides, but in particular on the right side of the war, on the liberating side of the war, on the side opposed to slavery, believed rightly that they were fighting a righteous war, a just war. And that's been rewritten. It's become a national tragedy. As I said, it's the one really glorious war the bourgeoisie fought and the one it's ashamed of. Now, to extend further some of this analysis or bring in another dimension to it or another angle on it, Kevin Phillips, in his book American Theocracy, in a chapter 4 called Radicalized Religion, makes this important observation. The South, he says, long ago passed New England as the region most caught up in manifest destiny and covenanted relationship with God. Just stop for a second. In other words, what he's saying here is in the history of the U.S., there was a whole religious tradition going back to the origins of the country in New England as sort of seeing the settling of America and everything as sort of an expression of a covenant with God. But that somewhat faded in New England through the history of the country and became much more powerfully asserted in the South. And it was asserted in the South by those who put this forward as both something that applied to the U.S. as a whole, and also, as we'll see, something that applied specifically to the southern U.S. and its way of life and its traditions. So he says, the South long ago passed New England as the region most caught up in manifest destiny and covenanted relationship with God. And referring with the term American exceptionalism to the notion that America occupies a special destiny and a special place in God's plan, and is marked by a special goodness, Phillips continues, the South has become the banner region of American exceptionalism, with no small admixture of Southern exceptionalism. In other words, in the eyes of people, particularly these religious fundamentalists, who are rooted in the South and the traditions of the South, America in general and the South in particular, is characterized by this special exceptionalism. So when it goes out and does evil in the world, it's automatically good, because it has a special goodness inherent in it, and what it does by definition is good and favored in a special way in the eyes of and has the support of God. And Phillips goes on to discuss how in the aftermath of the Civil War, in which the South was militarily defeated, the slave-owning system was militarily defeated, but after which, and particularly after the reversal and betrayal of Reconstruction in the South, quote-unquote, rose again in terms of political power and influence within the country as a whole. In connection with all this, Phillips points out, a religious mythology arose and was widely spread and took root widely among white people, that the white South had a special covenant with God and was the object of a special design by God to restore it to its rightful place, righting the terrible and horrible wrong that had been done through the Civil War. And Phillips makes the very relevant and telling comparison between Southern whites in the U.S. and white settlers or Afrikaners in South Africa, as well as Protestants in Northern Ireland and the Zionists who founded and ruled the State of Israel. It was always, when I read this, it just really set off a whole thing, recognition in my mind, because I always had sort of noticed this phenomenon and began to play a game. Whenever I'd see a Protestant Northern Ireland reactionary spokesman or an Israeli head or a settler in the West Bank or whatever, or an Afrikaner from South Africa, I used to close my eyes and try to guess which one it was, because their whole viewpoint and their arguments and rationalization were always the same. And Phillips makes a very telling and relevant point here in comparing Southern whites to these other groups. He says that all see themselves as people being restored to their right relation with God, reestablishing the broken covenant, and exercising a special divinely established destiny. And we should say this applies, despite the irony, with regard to the Zionist rulers of Israel in particular, that while many of them are actually secular, they nonetheless base their claim to the land of Palestine on religious scriptural grounds. And as Phillips sums up around this, quote, the reason for spotlighting history's relative handful of covenanting cultures, cultures that believe they have a special covenant with God, the reason for highlighting this, he says, is the biblical attitudes their people invariably share. What's in common between all of them? Religious intensity, insecure history, and willingness to sign up with an Old Testament God of war for protection. This is a very insightful observation on his part, and applies to the South of the U.S. and Southern whites in particular, and also applies to those drawn toward Christian fascism, literalist fundamentalism more generally in the U.S. And Phillips goes on, the importance of this in today's world has much less to do with the Northern Irish or Ulster Protestants and the white Afrikaners, and much more to do with Israel and with the American South and an evangelical fundamentalist American force generally. As Phillips puts it, Israelis, and to an extent, scripture-reading Americans, are on their ways to being the last peoples of the covenant. Phillips makes the chilling point that this outlook and the corresponding values are gaining currency and force among growing numbers of people all over the U.S. And ironically, as I pointed out, to even among those who are most directly oppressed by white supremacy. As this is increasingly spread beyond the traditional Bible Belt, and as this gains increasing weight within the ruling class of the U.S., it poses the prospect of the move to impose, through force and violence in the U.S. and on a world scale, all that is called to mind by the slave whip and the lynch rope. This is me speaking now. And today, again, employing the phrase I previously cited from Phillips, this is embodied as, and comes with the destructive power of, to use his phrase, the preemptive righteousness of a biblical nation become a high-technology, gospel-spreading superpower. Now, with regard to all this, along with the important insights in Kevin Phillips' book, American Theocracy, there are also important observations that are very relevant to this, made by Rabbi James Rudin in his book, The Baptizing of America, as well as by African-American theologian Dr. Hubert Locke in a talk he gave called Reflections on the Pacific School of Religion's Response to the Religious Right, which were delivered in May of 2005, and, as I've mentioned in the book by David Brian Davis, Inhuman Bondage. Now, one of the things that Davis speaks to in Inhuman Bondage is that, and this is something I also pointed out in the book Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That, that along with arguments from Aristotle about slavery and why it was justified, one of the main forms of justification for slavery among the apologists and defenders of slavery in the southern U.S. was the Bible, and in more particularly the story of the son of Noah, Ham, and his son in turn, Canaan, who incurred God's disfavor and were cast out and cast into the region of Africa. And thereby a curse was put by God on Ham, or more specifically on all of his descendants, beginning with Canaan. This is a story in the Bible that was repeatedly gone back to by apologists and defenders of slavery in the U.S. to justify slavery, that a curse had been put upon these people and therefore it was justified to enslave them. And we can see, even in more secular terms, the similar kind of arguments made to justify and reinforce white supremacy in things like the book The Bell Curve that came out and was promoted very aggressively in the 1990s. In setting out to justify oppressive relations in general, but more specifically and importantly, white supremacy, this book didn't rely so much on religious justification, but relied on pseudo-scientific explanations for the alleged inferiority and superiority of various groups, in particular, people of European and, they also said, some Asian origin, as compared to people of African origin. It's explicitly argued that on a genetic basis, there was an innate an unavoidable inferiority of people of African origin, particularly with regard to intellectual capacities. So this is another dimension that was added, but then increasingly, that particular form, this was raised to oppose affirmative action, but in generally to justify the unequal and oppressive relations and the ideology that went along with this whole structure of white supremacy built into the whole history and foundation and structures and institutions of U.S. society. But increasingly we see in these days religious fundamentalism being brought forward as a unifying ideological basis for the most openly reactionary political and ideological viewpoints and programs and forces, and bound in with this for all the reasons that I've been speaking to and quoting Kevin Phillips and other aspects of this, is, especially given the history of this country, an element, a crucial element, whether overtly stated or not, whether muted or hidden or more clearly expressed, a clear and unavoidable element of white supremacy. And the spread of fundamentalist religion, here is one of the great and bitter and acute ironies. The spread of religious fundamentalism, largely with the battering ram of the forceful reassertion of absolutist patriarchal authority, among those who are most directly the victims of white supremacy, is binding those people through the promotion of this religious fundamentalism, is seeking to bind those people into a more firmly into a whole process that will not only greatly intensify their oppression, but even has, as I will discuss shortly, genocidal implications. A situation in which already huge numbers of the population of inner city youth and, you know, Latino, but in particular black youth, huge percentage are already in prison or caught up in the prison and criminal system in one form or another. But even that is not the full extent of what this whole religious fundamentalism is bound up with as a program. There are even beyond that further genocidal implications. And here it's worth mentioning something that's spoken to by Ira Katznelson in his book, When Affirmative Action Was White. This is a book which, you know, he's within the bourgeois democratic framework and wants to see things restored back to the great society type programs that Johnson implemented and then were abandoned, which there's some truth to that, despite the fact that those programs were not intended to and could not have uprooted the oppressive relations and the impoverishment of large sections of the masses. But nonetheless, there's a lot of important insight and analysis in his book, When Affirmative Action Was White. And among the things he mentions, besides discussing in detail this whole way in which the New Deal policies and the policies through the GI Bill and the Federal Housing Authority and the Veterans Administration and so on served to actually reinforce and promote white supremacy and the widening of the gap between blacks and whites in the U.S., he discusses specifically how this affected colleges and universities and the disproportionate funds that went into universities from which black people still, even after World War II, were almost entirely excluded by policy or by the effective workings and policy. And on the other hand, the historically black colleges and the disparity in support financially and otherwise for the latter. I mean, the lack of support relative to what the white-centered universities got. But one thing that he mentions that jumped out at me in reading this as part of this overall analysis is he speaks about what was the very limited character of the curriculum of these traditionally black colleges with their limited resources and funding. But along with that, partly under the influence of the whole tradition of Booker T. Washington, their curriculum was largely limited to and emphasized three things: trades, teaching, and theology. There was a much greater emphasis in the traditionally black colleges on religion and theology than there was in these other universities from which blacks were largely excluded in this period and for many years, continuing after World War II. Now, Katznelson's focus here is particularly on the period right after World War II, but this casts a larger and longer shadow. It has broader application and implications and effects extending well down from then right to today. This promotion of theology, even in the traditionally black colleges and not simply through the black church, reinforced the role that historically had been played by the black church, which was a highly and acutely contradictory role. To a large degree, from the time of slavery, Christianity in particular was promoted by the slave owners among the slaves. Many of the slaves came from Africa where they had different religions, animist religions or other religions, and along with their change in their names and everything, and the other culture and customs, came the imposition, in effect, of Christianity. At the same time, as is not surprising, among an oppressed people, there was an attempt to use this master's religion to find ways to turn it around and use it as part of a means of fighting back against oppression, beginning with slavery. So, for example, in the traditional black, in the black religious tradition, the whole Old Testament story of the Israelites in Egypt, the whole theme of let my people go, and the story of Moses leading the people out of bondage and slavery became a powerful part of the religion. So it was sharply contradictory. But at the same time, and this carried right down through the civil rights movement, and it's taking an even more negative form today, at the same time, the role of the church was always a dual role. And the church of the role of the ministers constituting a certain stratum within the black population, particularly after slavery and after the reversal of Reconstruction and down to the 1960s and in altering forms down to today, has always been one of a dual role. A role of negotiating with the master or the oppressor to try to bring about some improvement in the conditions of the people, but always doing so in a way that would keep things from getting out of hand in a way that would fundamentally threaten the interests of the oppressors. Always waging the struggle or seeking to confine struggle that develops into a form and into an expression that wouldn't fundamentally challenge the oppressive relations. And it's a classical role, where basically the preachers would go to the oppressors and say, if you don't give me something, and Martin Luther King played this role explicitly too. If you don't, you know, in the midst of all the urban rebellions of the 60s, if you don't give me something, I'm not going to be able to control these masses anymore. This is the role that this whole stratum of black preachers has played historically, while they've always been portrayed as the leaders of the struggle. But the role has been much more and much more acutely contradictory than that. You can see this portrayed, for example, in a movie that came out in the 60s, which was not widely distributed, but it's an interesting movie, even with some of its limitations, called Nothing But a Man, which you can see by the title some of the limitations. But nonetheless, it's about this black railroad worker in the South who, because he's more mobile and works on the railroads and has some experience with unions, doesn't want to put up with all the shit that goes on, you know, in the whole fabric and the whole, you know, ensnarement of the oppressive relations, particularly rooted in the South at the time, in the early 60s. And so he gets married to, falls in love with and gets married to the daughter of a preacher and comes into very acute contradiction with the preacher because he's uppity and he doesn't want to put up with any shit. And he goes to work at a mill after marrying the preacher's daughter, and some of the white guys, the foreman and other white workers there, want to engage him and talk about what it's like having sex with his wife. And he's not putting up with any of that shit, so he really gets into conflict with the preacher who's, you know, he's going to upset the preacher's whole arrangement. Well, this is, you know, just a movie, but it captures a lot of the acutely contradictory role historically of this stratum of black preachers and of the theology that they have been the purveyors of. and the popular mythology that's promoted by the ruling class as well as by these preachers, that they've always been out in front leading the struggle. When in fact the struggle has repeatedly strained and off, and at times broken through the limits in which they are working to impose on it to keep this arrangement with the ruling class whereby they can get certain concessions in return for keeping the masses in line and from getting all out of bounds. And the fact that there was such a heavy emphasis on theology in the historically black colleges reinforces this and interacts with it. Now, clearly we can see how this very sharply is contradictory and divides into two, as we say, into positive and negative. But it should also be, two things should also be very clear. One, this ideology and the strata who purvey this ideology and who seek to play this role, while in circumstances and as part of the struggle, it is necessary to seek to build unity with them to the degree that can be done on the basis of the actual interests of the masses of people. It's necessary to be very clear that this cannot lead to real and complete liberation and will always seek to keep things within the confines of the system. And in significant ways in so doing will also stand in opposition to the struggle to break all the way through and achieve real and complete liberation. Preachers, to put it in short, can be united with and need to be struggled with, but they and their worldview cannot lead. And in the world today, the second phenomenon is there is a whole stratum or whole section of these black preachers which is openly going along with and promoting this Christian fascist program on the basis of asserting patriarchy in particular. And that cannot be united. Not only can that not lead, that cannot be united with them. It has to be very vigorously exposed and struggled against and called out for what it is. Now, an interesting aside here quickly, or you know, a secondary part of the picture. I was thinking about why is there such a predominance, not only in the U.S. military, is there a sort of an unusually large representation of people from the South, but more specifically, in the officer corps of the U.S. military, why is there such a predominance of people from white people from the South? I was thinking this has to do with the whole history of the South as a slave-owning system and then the system that replaced it in terms of sharecropping and plantation exploitation in that form, and the whole Southern aristocracy that grew up through that period of slavery in particular. And you think about, you know, the whole picture, you know, Gone with the Wind and all, you know, sitting on the verandas, drinking the mint juleps, and so on. And this whole aristocratic tradition, it's the same in England and so on, has as part of it a whole tradition that at least one of the sons goes into the military. Now, there are both ideological but also practical reasons for that. Because a system based on land ownership, well, here's what happens. People die. And when you have so much, when your whole system of wealth is based on land, to the degree you're not able to more intensely exploit people on the land, then there's a limit to how much wealth you can accumulate. And if you keep dividing the land up, you're going to undermine the wealth that can be gained. So one of the things that they did is often they would send one into the church and one into the military, so you wouldn't have so many sons to divide the land among. And this is all part of the culture of the South, and it's one of the reasons why, well, I guess I'm going to lapse into nationalism here or something, but why there's so many fucking crackers in the U.S. military officer corps. And this has its influence also in terms of the promotion of fundamentalist Christianity within the military. It's not the driving force of it, but it's a contributing factor, I think. But more important here is what I referred to earlier. Christian fascism and its genocidal implications. And one of the great ironies and injuries of the promotion of this religious fundamentalism among the masses of oppressed people who are the most direct victims of white supremacy already. In Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, I pointed out in regard to Pat Robertson in particular, and he's not alone in this, there's an advocacy of the traditional Old Testament biblical legal system. And what does that call for? It calls for public floggings of people and shaming and of people who commit minor offenses, and for people who commit more serious offenses, not just what are now considered capital crimes, that under certain circumstances are deserving of a death penalty, like homicide, but serious crimes that bring a stain upon the land and the people, and which bring the people into disfavor with God, should be punished by death. If you think back toward the beginning of this talk and all things I ran down the Old Testament that are punishable by death, things which are regarded to put a stain on the land, you can think of things like homosexuality, even adultery. But you can certainly think of all the things for which people are now imprisoned, particularly youth from the inner cities. And when you add that to a certain logic about why should we spend all this money housing these people in these prisons, you can very easily see the genocidal implications of this Christian fascist force and program. This is not hyperbole. These people are very serious about what they're seeking to do. And what did they say after 9/11? This was brought on by liberals, the ACLU, people upholding the right to abortion, homosexuals, and others like that. They brought the wrath of God on us. This is what these people argue. Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, they believe in this shit as the way to hold together this, the America that they envision as it should be, as it goes out into the world to carry out this grand design which they see in religious dimensions, of the destiny of this exceptional people to rule the whole world in their image and in God's image. At the same time as the other side of this, there is in religion, but more especially and particularly in literalist religious fundamentalism, the promotion of a slave mentality. Let's call shit what it is. The promotion of a mentality that sees people themselves as inherently sinful, that accepts the notion that the reason they're in the situation they're in today is because they have come into disfavor with God, because it's God's will, because they or others around them have committed acts which have brought down the wrath of God on them, and if anything good happens to them, it's because despite all this, God in his greatness and mercy showed compassion for them. This, let's call it what it is a slave mentality that with which people are being indoctrinated. All this, thank you, Jesus, is a slave mentality. It goes right along with God works in mysterious ways. And if you think about what I was saying earlier and everything that was spoken to about God and about Jesus, and what Jesus as a historical figure was actually like and what he really stood for, exactly what is it that you're supposed to be looking to and thanking? And what is the promotion of that idea that, you know, we're basically a helpless people who've brought this on ourselves by disfavoring God and can only hope that God will have mercy on us? What is that other than a slavish mentality? Now, some people are highly offended when you say things like this. But to paraphrase Malcolm X, I didn't come here to tell you what you want to hear. I came here to tell you the truth, whether you like it or not. Because it's a form of contempt for the masses of people to think that they can't be challenged with the truth and can't come to embrace the truth and take it up and wield it to emancipate themselves. When you say that people are being indoctrinated with and are even taking up a slavish mentality, you're not saying it's their fault. Or this is something they can't change. You're calling on them and challenging them to get rid of this, to rise to what they're actually capable of, and you're bringing to them an understanding of why they're really in the situation they're in today and what's the way out of this. But you can't do that without challenging this mentality. And you can't do it while being apologetic about challenging this mentality and calling it out for what it is. Now, some people say, with regard to black people in particular, religion is an essential part of the black experience. Well, I say, what about slavery? Or segregation in Jim Crow? Sharecropping in the KKK? Or continuing discrimination today, along with massive imprisonment and police brutality? Isn't all that, quote unquote, an essential part of the black experience too? The question is, if something is an essential or integral part of experience, what role has it played? And what effect does it have? Is it good or bad, positive or negative? Where did this religion, where did the worship of Jesus in particular come from? I've talked about the contradictory character and effect of this. But in today's world, where we are in the historical evolution and revolution of human relations, this religion, and all the more so in its literalist, fundamentalist form, is a direct obstacle, is a shackle, is a chain holding back the masses of people from being able to emancipate themselves and to leap beyond the situation where they feel drawn toward some kind of religion as consolation for the oppression and suffering. So once again, while we must unite and seek to build unity with many people of religious viewpoints, we have to be very clear on what can actually lead in enabling people to engage, to understand, and to transform reality in order to achieve an end to all these horrific conditions, of which on the one hand religion is a reinforcement, and on the other hand religion is sought as a consolation. To win real and complete emancipation means taking up a scientific, not a religious approach to understanding and changing reality, changing it through revolution. And especially fundamentalist religion that insists on taking the Bible or any other scripture literally and as the absolute and inerrant truth, and which refuses to believe anything that contradicts a literal reading of the Bible or other religious scriptures, that kind of religious viewpoint and conviction is extremely harmful. It can only keep those caught up in it completely in the dark about what is really going on in the world and afraid of trying to change the world in the only way it can really be changed, through resistance and ultimately the revolutionary overthrow of the system that is oppressing millions and billions of people here and throughout the world. Such fundamentalist religious fanaticism can only help to reinforce oppression and enslavement of masses of people. And in this spirit and this light, we have to grasp and we have to not be afraid to say boldly, oppress people who are unable or unwilling to confront reality as it actually is are condemned to remain enslaved and oppressed. That's the end of this section of this talk.